The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Thank you very much. In the dossier you have, please open at pages 4 and 5, the two of them. On page 4 is the table that we went over a fortnight ago, and for once it's problem 3. That is the option between cosmos and creation, etc., is resolved. Our whole culture, 100%, now believes that the world began, that it is developing and proceeding. There can be new things. Change is the essence of it, and it will end, the black hole maybe. So at the cosmic level, our current culture is totally unified on the character of the universe itself, and that is the imprint of Jerusalem, not of Athens. The other table on page 5, which we did a week ago, steps down to the social level, from the universal level to the social level, and should there be a state, law, and that kind of thing. And the choice that I gave at the bottom of that list on page 5 was the choice between ethics and morality. There is such a choice. Strangely enough, ethics is from the Greek word for custom, and morality is from the Roman word for custom. So they ought to be the same, but they're not. Everybody knows, no one gets angry about ethics, but they get very angry about morality. And here's the important thing. Whereas the philosophers and the historians agree on the universe, they disagree profoundly on the choice between ethics and morality. In particular, the ancient philosophers, and above all the contemporary thinkers, as they're now called — we don't have philosophers so much now, we have thinkers, did you know? Just as we have writers, strange, mysterious people who write. But the thinkers of our age lay it down that morality is a mistake. Ethics is what we want, and in particular, we want virtue. That is, the old agreed patterns of behavior that came to us from the Athenian tradition. And Nietzsche, the German rebel of the mid-19th century, laid it down crystal clear. Morality is simply the servility of the Jews imposed on the rest of us, and we should just ignore it. And contemporary high-grade philosophers say the same. There is no such thing as morality. It is only ethics. What then is ethics apart from custom? Well, of course, it's the tidy common sense, doing the ordinary right thing, without which no community, family, or anything would work. We're all dependent, and should be, on good, ordinary behavior of an ethical kind. But we don't get particularly angry about it, unless, of course, in a motor accident, the criminal element may come in, and then there's morality. You know it's morality, and not ethics, when people are angry. All the demonstrations in the streets, and the endless feelings of anger that people have — I don't know whether you have them, but as far as I can see, most people are gripped by indignation at what's going on, or even about themselves. It is this powerful inbuilt judgment which we're all preoccupied with. And that's why I have laid the table out like that. Now, here's a surprise. Go over to the appendix of this dossier and look at page 9 of it. The philosophers or thinkers are saying we must get back to virtue ethics. Now, this touches, of course, not just our community — ethical behavior requires a community, of course — but it touches our inner motivation. And our inner motivation should be towards virtue. It's funny, isn't it? Because virtue used to be a word we sneered at. We mocked people for being virtuous and regarding it as a kind of thing they shouldn't be. But the tide has changed, and there is a serious intellectual drive to recover virtue. That is praiseworthy, good, committed behavior. And I've put on that table, on little summary on page 9, some key things. Look under point D, about 6 lines down. You'll see 3 intellectual tactics. This is in your private behavior. And they're all Greek words, as you can see, and they're really important. Autarkeia is the practice of the cynic. The cynic was a Greek philosopher. The word cynic comes from dog. That was the contemptuous name for the cynics. But the principle that they followed completely was self-sufficiency. Nothing else matters except yourself, and you ignore other people. Diogenes, the great first cynic, lived in a barrel, so we're told. So he didn't have to relate to anybody else, but he became world famous for that. He was the first hermit, if you like. He went off to do it on his own. But he became world famous, and Alexander the Great wanted to see him. So he was marched up to see this phenomenon of a man who lived entirely on his own, and offered to give him whatever he would like. Since Alexander had the world at his control, he expected, of course, some fascinating request, which he would fulfill as the master of the world. Diogenes replied, "Don't stand in my sunlight." End of conversation. So, you know, many people in the academic world, in the last generation, have told us that the key to Jesus of Nazareth is that he was a cynic. Digest that. It's quite a serious proposal. Jesus is independent. He appears in the Gospels, not built in. He has a family, of course, but he's not going around with his family. Those brothers went round with him a bit. But when you think of his various sayings, you can see why the modern analysts think, well, this is old-fashioned cynicism. Certainly what Jesus' message is focused entirely on the individual self, you, etc., and me. It's the challenge to the individual which comes from Jesus. Now go back to page... try page 7. We're now at the level not of the universe or of society, but of ourselves individually. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on these things. You can take them away and think about them. But I put the word character in the left-hand column as being an Athens thing. I was upset when our elder son, who's here in this audience, said at my birthday that something about my character, and I was bridled by that and said, well, I don't have one. And I was wrong, of course, because the word character is changing. The Greek word, it is a Greek word, means engraving, as though something is engraved on your soul at birth. And in the ancient culture, although the philosophers didn't treat this, the culture as a whole assumed that it would show up in your childhood, the atrocities that you would do later, and so on. So in this sense, the word character was a kind of trap for blocking development, if you like. That's why I reacted against it, because the Jerusalem message is the opposite of that. It is that you are gifted, you are not predetermined. But the gifts of the Spirit will give you a distinctive thing, a new thing that you didn't have before, not your character. Nevertheless, the word character does now come in the modern Bible translations, and the truth is that We had shifted away from the idea of an engraved, predetermined thing, and the word character often does mean for us now, you've been through the mill of life, you've had challenges and dealt with them and so on, and you now have your character, that is, you're tested, that you've been tested. This is the essence of the biblical scenario, that we are tested by the Lord and tested by each other, testing ourselves. One's put to the test, and we now use the word character, I suppose, for a person who's stood through the test and changed, maybe. And anyway, so much for personal history. Notice three words from the bottom. I put down friendship for Athens. There was a studied doctrine of friendship, and you could learn to be a friend. That's interesting, isn't it? Because friends just arise. You don't have to learn to have friends. Suddenly you find you've got them. And you don't know why, but you have them. You know when you have friends, because you can trust them. They understand you and you don't have to explain anything with friends. But friendship wasn't like that. Jesus said, for example, you are my friends if you do what I command you. That would be the ruin of a good friendship. Now, I think, to dictate to your friend, wouldn't it? Friendship's not like that for us. We have mateship. Mateship's a good thing with a terrible bad side. It depends who your mates are. If it's a crook lot, then so much for the law. But friendship, then, is a puzzle. And the philosophers, which is what Jesus is reflecting, want a studied friendship. There are grades in friendship. You can be granted friendship. And Caesar, for example, if he grants you friendship, you can go into his house without company. But he could cancel you from the list and renounce your friendship. You would then commit suicide or something like that. So the test of friendship was a terrible test of individual development in antiquity. I've ended up this list with the choice between how to behave towards each other, between the modest, courteous conduct which treats everybody indifferently and politely but avoids entanglement of any kind. There's nothing wrong with courtesy. I'm not saying, by the way, that any of these things in either column is wrong. They're not the opposites of each other. They're alternative things which come from alternative parts of our heritage. And the courtesy is the language of court life. And it's essentially politeness. And modesty is moderation, not going to excess. All of these things are the individual imprint of the fixed universe. If everything is fixed, this is how you have to behave. But hang on, we don't have the fixed universe anymore, do we not? We're all agreed. The place is developing, it's not fixed. And so just how high a grade we put on modesty and courtesy remains to be seen. There was a debate recently on the ABC about Australian values, and with a panel. They couldn't work it out. There were no Australian values. Mateship, of course. But then they suddenly decided, the compere said at the end, oh, well, we've got one value which we agree on, a fair go. And a certain notorious journalist who was present in this, maybe not in this room, but in this city, whom you all know, interjected and said, no, not just a fair go. A fair go with passion. He was absolutely right, in spite of the fact that he's an arch critic of the churches, because it's the churches that told him the meaning of passion. I don't know whether you knew this, but I certainly know. People put a microphone to you and say, well, come on, what have you got to say? And the typical lead-in to this is, what are you passionate about? Now, some advice. Next time they do that to you, just reply, apathy. Because that's what the Stoics would have taught you to do in antiquity. The Stoics cultivated precisely that. It is their word, and the word apathy is the Greek word for dispassion. What does the word passion mean? It means suffering. One mightn't have thought that. You might have thought that in modern usage, passion means having a good time and so on, and yelling and shouting or whatever. Well, that's a form of suffering, according to the philosophers. We can't do it now, but read the text I've given you under the open heart on page 8. It takes a lot of reading and digesting. But there's Cicero wrestling with the Stoic and the Aristotelian versions of what's wrong inside us. And in spite of the fact that they could solve the universe and solve statecraft philosophically, none of the philosophers could get the problem of the inner man, as it were, which I've called the open heart. That's Paul's words. None of them could solve what goes wrong inside. Why does passion mean suffering? It's a Latin word, and the Greek word was pathy, as in pathology. What pathology means, of course, now is there's something fundamentally wrong that's gone on with your frame. It is a disease. In the passage on page 6, which we won't read now, Cicero is speculating on, is it really a disease when something goes wrong? He doesn't think so. But he does think we should divide the soul, he says. The soul has parts. It has a good part and a bad part. And somehow or other, the good part has to keep the bad part under control. And Plato, in a famous image, said, it's like a charioteer. You are a charioteer driving two horses. And one horse does the right thing all the time, and the other one is too passionate. He keeps bursting away and wrecking things. And somehow or other, you've got to live your life with the righteous soul controlling the passionate one. So how is it that we get this lovely word that we all love passion in all sorts of ways, and our culture as a whole is totally dedicated to passion? They are dedicated to the passion of Christ. That's where it comes from. What is the passion of Christ? It is when the Messiah himself, long promised to Israel, appeared, was recognized. Are you a king then? Said Pilate. Well, you said so, said Jesus. What is the truth? Said Pilate, and so on. The crucifixion was to get rid of that. That was the purpose of it, to bury the problem. But it projected it onto an entirely new level, the problem, how to behave, and so on. And very slowly, across the centuries, the suffering of Christ, imprinted also by imitation in the suffering of Paul, who saw himself drawn into a replication of it in his own life, gradually was elevated. By the 4th century, Jesus reigned from the cross. There's a picture of him that comes to us from Britain in the 4th century, of Jesus reigning from the cross. It's not quite like that in the New Testament, but the Roman Church, for example, has finally in the past century decided, yes, that's right, and there is now a festival of Christ the King reigning from the cross. That is, he has the solution to what's to happen, the judgment to come, for example, and it is on the cross, the point of suffering, that the price of it is dealt with, the cost. It's the cost of messiahship, the cost of what's to come, and so on. And so our beautiful culture, dedicated to passion, sails along in the imprint of this profound event of 2,000 years ago, and we all bear it indirectly in our preference for compassion. What does compassion mean? Sharing in the suffering. It's no good if you're a carer, for example, to deliver your care in an old people's home, say, cold-heartedly. Who wants cold-hearted care? Passionate care that shares the suffering, if you can enter into with take grief, if you share the grief, that's passionate care, and it's healing. Because the paradox is the suffering is the redemption. In the middle of page 9, there are the four virtues which they want us to go back to. Remember, the philosophers, the thinkers, want us to go back to virtue from Athens. And there's the four of them listed there. Those are their Greek words. And in brackets I put their Latin translations as they appear in English. Prudence, fortitude, temperance, justice. When they say we've got to get back to virtue, that's what we have to get back to. And what's justice? Not what you might have thought as lawyers. That's part of it, of course. But justice means, in the Greek language, doing the right thing in terms of its nature. And your nature is, of course, to be a slave if you're a slave, or to be a woman if you're a woman, etc., etc., etc. And whatever is natural, therefore, is to produce a sense of justice. We don't hold that view now, and it's one of the paralyzing elements in contemporary court life, as far as I can see. Whether we still cling to the literalistic Aristotelian view of quantified justice, or some kind of moral judgment, whatever moral is to be thought to mean. But here's the catch. Those four things are not, in my opinion, so-called Christian virtues. There are no Christian virtues. Why? Because virtue is the definitive key, and it comes in Latin. The word virtue, as you can see, comes from virility. Virtue is the quality of masculinity, much sought after by the feminists, actually. Things like courage, the militaristic virtue, gave the whole pattern of so-called meritorious behavior to the ancient world. And the churches should not have adopted, in my opinion, the classical virtues. I'm afraid that has happened in the 2,000-year history of the church. These four virtues have been canonized. Even in St. Andrew's Cathedral, Sydney, I have witnessed it. The St. John Ambulance celebration there, for example, one year said there are seven Christian virtues, and here they are. Well, I'm telling you, I regret to say, they are not Christian things. They do not come from the ministry of Jesus at all. And how do you get to seven? Well, this is the doctrine from 2,000 years of church history, really. You add Paul's three things, which he said were lasting things, which are there in little subsection 2 on page 9, and they are trust, pistis, anticipation is my translation for elpis, not hope. Hope sounds too much like optimism to me. There is no optimism worthwhile under either heading in our world now. But anticipation is what is meant by hope. Namely, somebody has promised you something and they will do it. That's hope. And agape, care, don't translate it love. The range of love in the English language is fantastic, of course, from erotic to this, to care. But it's the care end of it, meaning not, of course, cold-hearted care, but passionate care. You care and suffer with the other. That is the so-called virtue. But don't use the word virtue, is my advice. It's a muddle in the history of culture. Now, I'll give up.
Well, we're going to take a pause just for a moment, and you'll see in your leaflets there's a bunch of paper. If you'd like to scribble down a question there, Peter or myself will come around and pick it up in just a moment, and then Ed will be able to answer it for us. And you'll also notice there's a feedback slip there. This is the only way you get to find out about future City Legal events, so if you'd like to drop your email down there, we can pick that up and pop you on the list. I'll come around now and pick up the questions.
Can I say something more?
Yes, absolutely.
Just while you're writing down whatever you want to write down, look at page 8 and the fantastic story of Thersites in the top half. If you don't know it, I'll summarise it for you. The gods have decided to trap the Greek forces besieging Troy with a false plan. So the gods are going to lead you into a muddle, it says Homer. The plan is to go home. They've been there for years, and they're sick to death of besieging Troy and not getting anywhere. And so a popular movement develops amongst the soldiers. Good, we're going home. And they all got ready and started to get to their ships, ready to go home. The leaders, the so-called kings, decided to play a trick on them. Everyone is deceiving everybody else in Homer. And because they didn't really want to go home. They wanted to finish the war. So they tried to stop it. And then one of the representatives of the people, this is the Thersites, got up and said, come on, don't listen to the kings. They get all the prizes and we want to go home. And he sweeps all before him because suddenly the plot, the divine plot in heaven and the plot amongst the leaders is starting to fall apart and the ordinary people are taking over and they're going to go home anyway. This is a popular revolt. And Thersites is their spokesman. And look at what happened when you've got time to study it. There was a problem with Thersites. He was ugly. He had a bald patch on his head with a little bit of hair sticking out. It says so. And he was hunchbacked and in general horrible. And so although he was a highly successful and persuasive orator, as no one challenged, he was no good at fighting, self-evidently. And virtue, remember, is masculinity. And Thersites is a pathetic, misshapen residue of that. He can't really fight, but he can talk all right, and his arguments are compelling until Odysseus, one of the kings, confronts him and says, come on, you monster, give up. You don't count. And assaulted him with his scepter and knocked him to the ground. So the revolt was over, but guess what the men did? They cheered. This is booing in the stands, if you know what I mean. They booed him. They booed the victim, Thersites. They, the crowd, the men he was leading to save them, the popular revolt, sneered at him. Odysseus, of course, was right. He should have knocked him down. What doctrine lies behind this? The survival of the fittest. Our culture is deeply imprinted with this. And one of the traps that lies ahead for our universalized world is going to be the triumph of the fittest. The evolutionary doctrine says that. That's not the biblical doctrine.
On that note, the next question, does the desire not to offend other people lead us to be less genuine or authentic?
Well, yes. How to tell the truth when it's unkind to tell it? Now, it's a moral problem. I can't solve it in some words, but everyone knows it. My wife said one day, I think I must be dying.
You must be
dying, she said to me. She was very ill. Well, there's no answer to that question. I couldn't say, yes, I think you are. Nor could I say, yes, I don't think you are. Stop carrying on. There is no answer to hard questions often. And how to tell the truth, or rather refrain from telling the truth, when it's going to injure somebody, is a delicate moral problem, and we instinctively do it. But when does it become lying? That's the problem. I have no answer to that.
Now, on a similar line, we have a question about duties and responsibilities. We all have duties and responsibilities. Should we aim to be dutiful without passion, or should we try to carry out our responsibilities? Should we try to carry out our responsibilities without feeling? So, dutiful without passion.
Okay, that's a good question. Sure. Must we love our ethical rules? Do we love the road rules? Well, I love them. I like keeping them, actually. And actually, I got fined for driving through a red light the other day. And I suddenly thought, now, come on, stop whinging. And so I've decided to rejoice in it. And this is hypocrisy, of course.
You rejoiced in the fine.
Yes, I said, I'm willingly paying this fine, I said, knowing that, in fact, I hated paying it. But I'm willingly paying this fine for a good cause that I believe in, namely the ethically correct rule about how to drive through traffic lights, i.e. not when they're red. And I'd done it quite deliberately because there were no other cars in sight. And I said to him, I said, well, there are no other cars in sight, so why shouldn't I go? It was a good common sense thing that I was wrong. I was photographed and of course, was irritated to be fined. But now, as I say, I now hold to this doctrine. I've made a great contribution to road safety by giving the government a bit more money for more cameras.
Thank you very much. All right, along a similar line, a question about passion. Is passion or joy inconsistent with Stoic ideals of quietly pursuing what nature intends?
Well, in church life, at any rate, I think most people marry these things very happily. They conceal their passion and stick to the routines. Whenever things are routine, we're on the ethical side of things. But the routine is essential, like the road rules. It won't work without the routines. Even your daily life, I live alone, but I still have to have my routine, otherwise things fall out. I broke my routine this morning and I've got no glasses. Now, this is a problem, but the routine would have solved it if I'd done the right thing. This is solely on my own. And that applies in general. That the whole ethical structure is, of course, sensible. Unless we're going to live in our individual barrels, like Diogenes, the cynic, then there have to be agreed patterns. I know some I understand there are cultures like the Highlands of New Guinea, say, where there are no clocks, and therefore there are no agreed patterns of the kind we depend upon. Like clocks are, after all, only an agreed pattern. And that they're very useful, surely. What was the question?
The question is passion or joy inconsistent with Stoic ideals?
Okay, well, the important thing is, I think if you just loved your routine so profoundly, that is, that you became you're virtually a mechanical cynic, I think. I'm blaming myself here, because I'm like this. I just like everything to be routine and the same. I like to eat the same things and do everything the same. And I'm content with that. It makes life easy. That I am angry about some things. No one, I hope, ever notices it, and so on. And in church, this is the problem in church life. It's very difficult to know how to express one's passion. Everyone has passionate feelings, unless you're immune to reacting. It's instantaneous. You see people on a daily basis whom you've never seen before, and you react without helping it. You know instantly whether you like them or dislike them. It's a problem, a profound problem. Why do we instantly respond or not respond to a person we just bumped into? And so we, as it were, cling to our customary securities and hope to not have to show our heart, as it were. And people get away around this in church by church music, because when the hymns are on, then you can show your heart, as hoping nobody else is actually hearing your poor voice as you sing. I had this catastrophe in St. Andrew's Cathedral once long ago when I took friends in there, and we sat up in the front in the Queen's seat because it was a distinguished visitor, and I sang mightily to support the cause. As we were going out, the Dean, who was not the present Dean, of course, gave me a broad grin and said, "We must recruit you for the choir." I at once decided passion is a lost cause. Never again will I sing in church, and so on.
That's a shame. The question here about Jesus reigning on the cross, the question is, how is that the solution, and what is it the solution for?
It's not a solution to the history of the world, exactly. It's certainly a valid solution for our present culture, but in a dangerous way. Because
you say it's a solution in a dangerous way.
Yes.
Well,
take the tremendous protection for the weak, which our culture absolutely insists on now.
Or is that being eroded at the moment?
Well, it can't last, really. There'll be a counter swing. You see, there is an evolutionary process, and I've argued that this is the imprint of the biblical view of the world, that is, that it is a world in the making, going towards its end. So it's authentic to the Bible, if you like, to Jerusalem, and yet, as a purely biological process, it leads to the survival of the fittest. And all this business of saving species that are about to die out and so on will apply, if we go on like this, to the human race in due course, and the survival of the fittest will polish us off and so on. So what do we do then think of Thersites getting knocked over because he couldn't survive amongst the fittest. Will that become, I fear it will, as the world population grows more and more enormous and the huge technical changes give everybody huge power, even individuals with little capital can still have instant access all around the world. The overwhelming reality of all this technical change will lead to explosive results at some point, I think. I can't see how it can be otherwise, and the explosion will be the survival of the fittest. What is the President of the United States doing at the moment? He is exercising a determination to survive as the fittest. Make us great again.
A question here. Thomas Cranmer said, what the heart wants, the will chooses and the mind justifies. How different is this from Plato's two horses, reason and passion?
I'd like to write an answer to that. I'm sorry, I'm a bit confused.
Sure. Was temperance and justice displayed in the destruction of Carthage on the descriptions of Sulla? And is hope expectation? So two questions, the second going to your definition of hope as expectation. The first, was temperance and justice displayed in the destruction of Carthage on the descriptions of Sulla?
It's interesting that at the destruction of Carthage, which was actually in 146 BC, and the destroyer was Scipio Aemilianus, and the Greek historian was a Polybius, whom we have, was present and witnessed this. Scipio wept at the destruction of Carthage, Rome's epochal enemy. And when he was asked why he was weeping, he said, "I am weeping for Rome, because this will be the fate of Rome one day." I don't know whether that answers the question, but I'll come back to that if you give it to me.
Okay. The next one was, is hope expectation, the second part of the question, is hope expectation in terms of your definition of pistis?
Yes, it's elpis, is the Greek word for hope. And for most people love hope, of course, but what they're really doing, I think, generally is taking an optimistic view of life. An optimistic view is just an illusion, I think. But the kind of hope that's being talked about in the New Testament is a hope with a brilliant prospect before it, a promise. The key to it is the resurrection of Christ. Whatever you make of the resurrection of Christ, that is the fountain of hope in the Christian theology. And it is because of the promise that is inherent in that, that one hopes. I must say something about the soul. One of the triumphs of Athens in our culture is the belief that is general in the community that when we die, our soul will fly away, and in some sense, we still exist, perhaps in a cloudy area or something we can't see, and we can speak to the soul or want to. And indeed, in Roman Catholic piety, one can speak to the departed in prayer, you can pray to them, and so on. But in the general culture, the soul means something about us that disappears but hasn't really disappeared, and the real us somehow is there, and we may see it one day. This kind of thing is virtually universal. It does not come from Jerusalem. It comes from Athens. That is the Platonic doctrine that our predicament is that we have a soul trapped in a body. This was Plato's view. The body is where the problems are, not the soul. The soul is a pure thing. It's pure truth and reality. And indeed, it's more real than the body. And so the aspiration in the classical philosophical tradition is for the soul to be freed from the body which and all its problems and rise to its real, to the real ideal, that is the ideal form of life undefined. And that has been tremendously powerful down to now. It negates the biblical scenario, actually. Don't tell me now to explain that. But so don't think I'm running down the classical side. The classical side of our culture is profound in all sorts of ways, just as the biblical side is. And what this series is about is trying to see where the emphasis lies and what our real choices are.
Okay. We've got another question here. We've got time for maybe one or two more. It's to do with virtue ethics. A lot of our educational institutions are fully embracing virtue ethics as their new paradigm.
Yeah.
What are the problems with that? And the second question is, can there be ethics/virtue without morality? Going back to your definition of those terms. So the first question, is there a problem with adopting virtue ethics?
Yes.
As many of educational institutions are doing.
Yes, the problem with virtue ethics is crystal clear if you look at the tables in the appendix. Don't do it now. But in my judgment, the four classic ethics that are listed there, the four classic virtues, and with the word virtue as the collective term for the four of them. Incidentally, no ancient Greek philosopher said that those were the four. But the whole philosophic tradition from Athens believed in the fourness, that is the quadrilateral structure of reality. That's why they have four. But no philosopher, as far as I know, said they must be those four. The popular culture did, just as our popular culture still believes in the soul, for example. But these four things come out clearly in writer after writer. But what are they? Here's my definition. They are properties of the soul. I use the word properties deliberately. You have these things. If you have courage, it's you who are having it. You can knock those attitudes out and show your courage, you see. Similarly with those other things. And the only thing where it looks social is justice. But that's deceptive because, as I've tried to argue, and it's not a secret, the Aristotelian doctrine was that the differentiation between classes, sexes, etc., is natural and therefore right and true and therefore just. It is just that you should be in slavery because your reason is inferior. That's the Aristotelian stated doctrine. So when it says that justice is a virtue, they don't mean the justice of the law courts in particular. They mean that you should behave in relation to other people by accepting the justness of who you are. I am a slave, and that's it. And do nothing about it. It's not a problem, that's justness. That's what they mean by justice. Now compare the three Pauline things which last. They are not qualities of the individual. They are, in my opinion, responses to other people. This is entirely my bright idea. Virtue is the property of your soul, what you have. You have those things and you cultivate them. The classical philosophers will tell you how to cultivate temperance and moderation and so on. You can learn it and study it, and this is what they did in higher education, trying to be apathetic. Like, I love our students when they campaign to be apathetic. They would have done that in antiquity. That was their ideal then, for the good life, to not be overthrown by passionate demands on you, but to fortify yourself in your virtue. And that's the trap with virtue ethics. We're going to teach people in school now to shrink back into your little fortress of your own soul. Cultivate these good things. There's nothing wrong with the virtues. They are good things. But They're not for anybody else, they're for you. It's so his self-development, and there's nothing wrong with you. That, guess what the negative word in virtue ethics is? We have it already, everyone's using it every day. Inappropriate. Nothing wrong, of course, with other things or what other people do, just that they may be inappropriate. That word is constantly used. It's the only effective word now for bad. And so virtue ethics, in brief, is you cultivating yourself for yourself. The Pauline trio is you responding to a demand that is made upon you by somebody else and suffering, if need be, with them. That's passionate compassion. We value that too. Our culture wants that too. So our education system is fighting a contradiction, if you like, or promoting a contradiction. It'll be fascinating to see how it works out.
Well, thank you so much. Please join me in thanking Professor Judge for being with us today. Thank you.
Okay.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.